I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The shock of migrant kids in cages on our border with Mexico is surfacing tough questions if you're willing to look back at our history and ahead to an emerging world disorder. The issues run deep. Why borders in the first place? Borders that our investment money and military power fly over anyway, often to extract the resources of poor countries and make sure the poor people stay put. When finance and Facebook, food, trade, disease, and the weather are all global systems, who's ready to say, I am a citizen first and last of the world? East Boston, on the rim of Boston Harbor, is where we take the temperature and check the flavor of the melting pot. It's the point where the first Kennedys came ashore from Ireland, then Italians from Abruzzo, who made Easty their own, and then Central Americans from Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, in the present day. In Trump time, the scare words in East Boston are gentrification, meaning displacement by wealth, and immigration, meaning how did you get here? Let's see your papers. This week I went asking which danger is closer and worse. In East Boston, what does your friend from Salvador worry about? That the landlord's going to say, we're gentrifying and you're out of here, or that ICE is going to be on the doorstep saying, you're gone?
With no doubt, immigration. I think that people are afraid of losing their houses, but the number one thing for them is they don't want to see ICE coming to their house and detain them and their families because they are afraid to go back to El Salvador.
Patricia Montes, herself from Honduras a decade ago, welcomes the vulnerable at the Centro Presente office on Central Square. First thing you'd notice, the poster villain on the wall of her office is not Donald Trump, it's Barack Obama. In a mocking retake of his vintage hope image, the new caption says 1,600,000 deportations. Then, all caps, Obama, stop tearing our families apart. What bothers Patricia Montes as much as anything is a sort of fact-free, fake-innocent ignorance among many of us Americans.
People in the U.S. think that people from Central America are regular migrants looking for better economic opportunities, but that's not the reality of the Central Americans right now. People are not necessarily coming for the American dream, quote-unquote. They are coming because they are trying to save their lives. You go to the U.S. or you stay there and you can die. I think it's the history of Central America have been invisible, but there is a long history and connection between that crisis that Central America is facing right now with the long history of the U.S. economic, political, and military intervention. And I think that the crisis that we're facing right now is the result of that connection.
Patricia Montes strikes a keynote of this radio hour in the suppressed history behind the gruesome crisis this spring, Dateline Brownsville, Texas. Kids by the hundreds wrenched from their parents, warehoused in the old Walmart on the border with Mexico. Our guests, Atusa Araxia Abrahamian and Rana Dasgupta, both have books in progress on the strange ways the world works to serve capital that goes everywhere and people who are supposed to stay home. We begin with Matthew Cameron, an immigration lawyer who practices on the dock, literally, in East Boston. Matt Cameron, you're our man on the front. Is due process still working out there?
Today, as we speak, sure. But ask me again in a few months.
You work in the flow of migrants today, Matt. Make your own generalizations about who the refugees are or the migrants are and why they're here.
They're strivers, they're seekers, and above all, they're refugees. They're people who are here not, as Patricia said, not necessarily even for a better life, but for a life to live. But imagine what it takes to leave everything, to leave everything you've ever known. Imagine what you have to actually be going through to bring your children here under the circumstances that we're seeing on the border right now. These are very impressive people.
We are made this country by the people who left someplace, and it's a big choice. Sure. In the very first place. Examples. that stand out for you embodying the type?
Well, I think of my own great-grandparents. And
no, but I mean, I'm thinking today. I think
no,
of my
I know. I see them, though. I see my great-grandparents and these people, but so much more so, the intensification of this refugee crisis. And my great-grandparents came for better lives, but the people that we're talking about, every one of them are fleeing extortion, kidnapping, torture, rape, murder. I don't hear anyone coming up here and saying I could live just as safely at home.
Does that matter? Is that a crucial legal distinction that I'm under threat of death? Not with an order from the government, but just life is terribly unsafe in Honduras or wherever.
Well, the law of asylum requires not just that you show that you're afraid to go back, but that your fear is based on something the government recognizes, and it has to be a legal basis. And that is the problem with most of these Central American cases. I consider them to be refugees, but the law does not. Not necessarily.
So where does the argument go?
We do everything we can to show that we can put these people into a box, essentially, into a category that the government can recognize. And sometimes it works, oftentimes it doesn't.
You'd let almost everybody in. Isn't that fair to say?
If it were up to me, certainly the people I'm working with.
And why? What justifies a sort of open border mindset now?
The way things are right now is actively killing people. It's immiserating people. And even if you don't care about the humanity, and I hope that you do, those listening to this, there's a tremendous economic inefficiency in having people that are willing to work this hard, contribute this much, do so much for our country, be kept down in their home countries, and be kept down here, frankly.
I've met some of your clients before, and it's astonishing. I mean, it's moving to hear the sacrifices people have made, and some of it's simply incredibly persistent educational effort, you know, apprenticeship, work, two jobs, three jobs, this kind of thing. I also suspect there's a huge economic benefit in letting almost all of these people in.
Absolutely.
Has that been counted, calculated?
It's very hard to do. It's an informal economy. And in many ways, I think this country wants it to remain an informal economy. It's in unfortunately, our national interest for it to be an informal economy and for these people not to have the opportunities that I think they should have.
Matt Cameron, I want your view on what feels like a collision coming, or maybe a trial of the soul of the immigrant nation. President Trump is reveling in his anti-immigration politics, his phrasing, and he got Supreme Court approval this week for his Muslim ban. At the very same time, there's an overnight star in Democratic politics in New York, soon to be an insurgent congresswoman from the Bronx and the Queens. She'll be, at 28, she'll be the youngest congressperson in American history. She's a socialist, and she made her case for easing up on the border, if not opening it entirely. How can these two things be going on in one country on page one at the same time, and how does it come out?
Well, I'm optimistic enough to believe that the majority is with us, is with those who would like to see more opportunities, less oppressive enforcement, if not no enforcement at all. Trump was only elected by a third of the United States, and he continues to be supported by about that much. And I think that when people see the stories that they're seeing right now coming out of ICE, coming out of the border, coming out of our system, there has to be a pendulum swing the other way. I'm still optimistic enough to believe that.
Speak about ICE. Your T-shirt, I'm looking at it, says abolish ICE. I didn't see hide nor hair of ICE in East Boston this week, but do you?
We do. I actually had a client picked up in East Boston District Court just last week. The probation officer told me it was the first time in 40 years he'd seen ICE inside the courthouse. They've been hanging around a lot outside. But the presence is there. It's not as prevalent as ICE would like it.
Do they have those black jackets on and helmets or not?
Plain clothes for these kinds of arrests. And quietly, they come to people's homes. People have to understand right now, it's targeted enforcement. There is no house-to-house raid. There's no patrol. There's no checkpoint. They know who they're coming after for the most part right now. But Trump wants to triple the ground force, so that could change.
We're a sort of sanctuary city in Boston and many others in this country. Does that mean that the Boston police, municipal police, don't help ICE, or do they? What's the exchange of intelligence and identities and suspicious characters or whatever?
Officially, no. There's no information sharing, but the federal government has access to our state records, and they watch as the arrests come in. They can find people, and they're free to enter the city and do whatever they will. We just can't have state and local law enforcement working with them. We're actually a sanctuary state following the decision from the SJC last year.
Imagine how the confrontations unfold politically, but also, you know, government to government, I mean, layers of government in this country. This is going to be an interesting year, all the more with a conservative, more and more conservative Supreme Court. Presumably Donald Trump is going to nominate a telltale candidate for the court very, very soon. Where does it go? But and how would you want it to go? Who's your advocate out there?
Certainly, last night's election was very exciting. We like to see more of those candidates. I think we will, because I think people are starting to see that this is a critical moment right now for immigration in this country. If Trump gets his way, if Republicans get their way, we will have three times as many deportation officers in this country. And I think United States citizens will start to notice, because they'll become a ground force. They'll be something that is prevalent that we can see. We have to decide right now whether or not we want that in this country, and that's why I support the complete abolition of ICE, as do many more and more Democrats coming out now. It's becoming more of a mainstream position. I'm very happy to see that.
Patricia Montes, as you heard, challenged us to learn our own history and learn the impact of American economic, financial, I mean, political, economic, and military interventions in Latin America, sort of forever. What is your short history of what we don't know that's contributing to this so-called crisis?
It's a pretty long history. It's hard to sum up too quickly, but it's certainly more than a century, much more than a century of interference, as she said, on every level, every parts of the system, and certainly this presumption that we have some right to be there and to meddle with these countries. And now, in a very real sense, we are paying for it. These are our refugees. These are our problems. I think that if Afghanistan or Iraq—
What would it take country to recognize that? I was in Central America.
Sure.
It's 30 years ago. But in especially memorable Nicaragua and Salvador, we were at war, the Contra War with Nicaragua. Salvador was one scary place, and we were with the bad guys.
Sure.
But we've never acknowledged it. I don't think most people have the foggiest idea, not to be blamed. But how do we raise our consciousness?
We have to understand that what's going on now is directly related to what was going on then and what we did then, and certainly what we did before then. But this gang problem, the way that these countries have been hollowed out and been completely corrupted, it's because we destabilized these governments so badly. And we have to take responsibility for that. It's a moral responsibility this country must own.
A few politicians used to. I remember Father Drynan, especially when the priests got killed, the nuns, and, of course, the Archbishop of Salvador. But the country's looking for a champion of that reality, and we've got to hear more about it. Coming up, Matt, so many echoes of Casablanca, the movie, in all of this. Who's got the exit visa? Who will be on the last plane out of the inferno of Europe in World War II? Ingrid Bergman, Humphrey Bogart. And then, too, mobility was a privilege rooted in citizenship and money. Coming up, this is Open Source. Talking about immigration, is it a manufactured crisis? And if so, who manufactured it? Our guest is a model of modern mobility, Russian and Armenian family roots. She's had addresses growing up in Canada, Iran, Switzerland, now New York. Atoussa Araxia Abrahamian wrote her first book on the Cosmopolites, the coming of the global citizen. In that and everything you write now about migration, Atoussa, the theme is inequality, blatantly on our border with Mexico. Does it have to be that way?
No, it doesn't have to be that way. I can't think of many countries that are actually full. I can't think of many countries that wouldn't benefit from more immigrants. Immigrants are wonderful. There's data to back that up. I think culturally there's a lot to be said for that. Not everyone agrees, of course, but no, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think there are plenty of people who'd like to change the way it is.
When you look at the awful coverage from the border of Mexico, what goes through your mind about this eternal, unresolved, misunderstood reality?
Well, the first thing I'd point out is that it's framed as this huge crisis, but the numbers don't really reflect that. Net migration to the U.S. is quite low. A couple of years ago, it was at net zero. Now it's maybe a little bit more than that. But these aren't people who have to be stuck at the border. They're stuck there because they are stopped, because they are prevented from proceeding, going through normal procedures to apply for asylum. And, you know, they're being locked up. So this isn't necessary by any means.
In terms of the world, there's a whole lot of migration in the world. Let's not forget that. To me, though, it's a marvel that the United States government is not accountable to its citizens and to Europe, to the world, for a refugee problem that our own military and other policies had a big hand in creating since Vietnam and Cambodia. And not that their problems were even then, but today, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, incredible displacement under American bombs. Mightn't Angela Merkel be chiding Donald Trump for creating a problem that she's tried to solve? And should we be thanking her?
If Angela Merkel tries to chide Trump, I wish her luck. I don't think that it would end very well for her, at least not on Twitter. The U.S. is definitely responsible for creating a lot of the refugees that are seeking shelter today. About a year and a half ago, I was at a demonstration after the first travel ban was announced, and there was a very telling sign that I saw. It said, if you don't want refugees, stop creating them. And I think that that really hit the nail on the head there.
I've been waiting for somebody to say that. I mean, the silence on that point seems to me deafening. Why Europe doesn't hold us responsible for the refugees coming out of South Asia, but also the Middle East.
Right. I mean, I think geography really plays to America's advantage here. It's much harder to get here. You can't just take a boat across the Mediterranean. Not that anybody just takes a boat. It's a harrowing and dangerous journey. But Europe is much more proximate to many of the places that are, you know, in disarray, for sure.
It's a little disconcerting, a little scary, Atoussa, to feel the rut we're in, talking about immigration and borders. And I cite three familiar, dare I say, presidential voices coming up here, all using the same set of buzzwords to disguise what they're talking about and what they're doing.
It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
Even as we are a nation of immigrants, we're also a nation of laws. Undocumented workers broke our immigration laws, and I believe that they must be held accountable, especially those who may be dangerous. That's why over the past 6 years, deportations of criminals are up 80%.
If they see any weakness, they will come by the millions. We have to have strong borders. We're going to have the wall. We're going to have the wall. We've already started it.
Atoussa Abrahamian, write us a new book here. I mean, tell us a new story, for crying out loud.
Well, what all the politicians miss when they talk about immigrants is that there are several classes of immigrants. Not all immigrants are the same. Not all immigrants come from the same places. And not all immigrants have the same means. So something that I talk about a lot in my book is that it's significantly easier for wealthy people to travel, to move, to have the, you know, privilege of mobility than it is for poor people to do the same thing. This inequality is reflected in many different areas, from the very mundane fact that often when you want to cross a border, you have to obtain a passport, which costs money. You have to apply for a visa, which costs money. When you apply for a visa, you have to show that you have funds that, you know, to make sure that you don't overstay your visa and stay in the U.S. or in Europe. So, you know, those are the smaller costs. Mm. But on a bigger level, you can literally buy a green card in the U.S. And this isn't something that is controversial among, you know, the Trump administration. This is something that the Kushner family was involved in.
Right. They're dangling them all over the billionaire class in China, right?
Yeah. 85% of applicants to the sort of green card for sale program called EB-5 came from China. And it's an incredibly popular program. And, you know, it gets some flack once in a while from politicians, but it still hasn't really been abolished. So there's definitely a double standard.
Matt Cameron, this is your moment to talk back to Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Donald Trump. What's wrong with that pitch? It's all the same, too.
It certainly sounds good, but we have to remember that in 1965, we ended unlimited migration in the Western Hemisphere, and a lot of the problems that we see flow directly from that. We essentially at that point created the idea of the undocumented person. There was sort of, you know, the idea before, but we did not have a massive undocumented population. We weren't keeping track of them. Internal deportation wasn't really an issue. And it became...
What had we had before? You walk across, you're in?
Certainly. The very free flow of people. The southern border was not really much of an issue for almost all of American history because the agriculture on the southern border desperately needed those workers to come and go, and that was very important. But we created a system in which we had this incentive was still there, but we stopped issuing the visas. We stopped Western Hemisphere immigration as we knew it. And while the work was still there, we forced them to stay here as a permanent underclass, essentially.
Who's we?
U.S. government policy.
But agricultural interests?
I think it's very much in their interest not to have any kind of legalization or not to have what Bush called a blue card program, because unless you want your salad to cost $25, that's where things are going to be.
What put the fever pitch in Bill Clinton's voice in the mid-90s?
That was Bill Clinton trying to be tough on crime and tough on immigration, and that caused more hardship and suffering than anything that any modern U.S. president or Congress has done. Was the 96 bill that completely changed everything about the immigration system in a very real way, in ways that certainly couldn't have been anticipated, I think, and some of the drafters even have said now that we didn't know where it was going, but continue to cause real permanent suffering for the people I work with.
Atusa, you write about the purchase of legality. What about the creation of illegality? That's what Matt's talking about here, a kind of, now it's going to be illegal and we're going to have a new class of people called undocumented, but then sooner or later, very quickly, they're illegal aliens, they're threatening, and by now with Donald Trump, there are millions of them and they're gangsters.
All of them, right? Exactly. I mean, this is a manufactured problem insofar that if you give an undocumented person papers, they're not undocumented anymore. When you look at it that way, it's a pretty easy thing to fix. Everything that you were talking about reminds me of analogous, not totally analogous, but maybe comparable, useful situation to look at in the Gulf states, in the Persian Gulf, where in the United Arab Emirates, in Kuwait, you have tens of thousands of people who are completely undocumented. They're not illegal. They were born in these countries. Their parents were born in these countries. Their grandparents were sometimes born in these countries. And yet they have been routinely and repeatedly denied citizenship of the UAE and of Kuwait because their great grandparents didn't sign up, or because they're from the wrong tribe, or because they live in the wrong region. This is a systematic and manufactured documentation crisis. It can be solved literally with the flick of a pen. And the fact of the matter is that when there's no political will to solve these problems, they don't get solved. And the people who suffer are the people on the receiving end.
What does the magic pen write? What are the words?
At this point, it would probably be a little bit more complicated. It would be, some keystrokes and maybe some biometrics put into a computer. And ultimately, you get a passport and an ID card.
I should add. Good. That's really very much. Yes, that's very much our future that was just described there in the UAE. France and Germany already have a similar sort of caste system where there are certain people who can never become French and German citizens. Republicans in Congress right now, the proposal for DACA that seems to be winning out, or that was until recently, was to create a class of people that could never gain citizenship. There's active discussion about repealing birthright citizenship. That's a very dangerous road to go down. That's something that, that what we call the helot class or helot class in Greece. Didn't end well for them.
I agree. I find that prospect absolutely terrifying and undemocratic as well.
You mentioned biometrics. What does technology, including biometrics, but the whole digital premise of life, do to create the problem, and how could it help in solving it? I mean, who was it that wrote? Was it you, Atusa, that passports will soon be over because biometrics, iris readings will tell the world, tell anybody exactly who you are, where you've been, and what you're up to. But what is the technical connection here?
Yeah, so some analysts and researchers believe that the days of the passport will soon be over, that we're going to be identified by facial scans, by iris scans. We'll just, you know, breeze through security at the airport and hop on the plane because there'll be cameras everywhere and everybody will know who we are. There are tons of problems with this from a civil liberties standpoint. But when we're talking about identification, national identification, and, you know, how it plays out in ports of entry and borders, it's you know, adds a level of difficulty, because if you're identified by your very, you know, essentially your DNA, your body, there's no way around that. In the past, and I wrote about this and you mentioned it, in the movie Casablanca is a great example.
Yeah,
where
please.
So everyone thinks of Casablanca as a love story during war, but it's also a movie about exit visas, about the lengths to which people will go to obtain documents to leave a country where they're not safe. And at the time, in the 40s, people were able to get forged documents, and maybe they'd pay off an official and get the signature and hop on the boat. But what I, you know, try to bring up in the piece is that if the forged document is replaced by your eyeballs, there isn't really much you can do to escape that.
Casablanca also has innumerable classic lines, but including Humphrey Bogart's telling that poor girl who's trying to seduce him, she's trying to get papers, and he says, "You want my advice? Go back to Bulgaria."
Worst advice ever.
Patricia Montez, I asked her the question, does she ever advise people, and she knows both sides of the border. I know the United States. I know the illusions. I know the problems back in Honduras, but I'd advise you to stay and fight. She said it's too personal a judgment to thrust on anybody, but the question is out there. Why not go back to Bulgaria? Why not? Can we presume to say, no, Honduras needs you. The fight for a decent country back home is important. Matt, do you ever confront that question?
Certainly, that's a personal choice that some people could make. But when people are at our borders seeking our protection from problems that we had very much to do with, I don't see that it go back home and fix your own problems as an answer. I just don't. And that's the purpose of the asylum system. And that's why we have the refugee system that the UN set up so long ago.
Is there any justice? I mean, can you get justice out of an asylum system proving the danger if you're not actually being chased by police?
Certainly.
How do you do it?
A lot of it does come down to your word. We certainly do require a lot of documentary evidence, but consistent, credible testimony can be enough to gain asylum. And I've certainly had many clients do that.
Atusa, you're a young woman with a real handle on a big problem. What's the future of this discussion? How do we make it more less vituperative, less stupid?
Oh, I can't say I'm feeling too optimistic right today. I am encouraged by the fact that I think something like 75% of Americans are actually fine with immigrants. They like immigrants. They want more immigrants. Places with more immigrants tend to be more friendly towards them. That suggests that, you know, just being around people who are from abroad could go a long way in changing attitudes. I think, you know, on the political level, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I can't vote. But, you know, Americans should do their part and vote for what they think is right. And I think that the more discussions we have about it, the better. Hopefully they'll be, you know, more or less coherent.
Are you ready to risk it, Matt Cameron? The a test with a champion like the young woman who's going to be congresswoman from the Bronx against this kind of almost immeasurable nativism that's in all of us, I suppose. We love our place.
The stakes are too high not to. We absolutely have to take this issue on, and we have to confront it now, because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves in 10, 15, 20 years, and I'm not engaging in hyperbole here, with a Guantanamo Bay within our borders. We're going to find ourselves with a deportation force that's in the street and a regular part of our daily lives throughout the country, and we're going to wonder how we got here, and we have to confront it now.
It feels surely like a replay of the Bernie kids in New Hampshire discovering a sort of commonsensical, practical American socialist mentality that resonated quickly. The New York Times, which didn't anticipate Bernie, didn't anticipate our lady, and I'm blocking her first name, last name Cortez, but Alexandra, and that's still not the whole name. But it's tempting to believe, even in one's own heart, that that's who we are.
It's who we'd like to be. It's who I'd like to see we are. But, you know, we have to remember that the very first bill passed by Congress after the original 1790 Naturalization Act was the Chinese Exclusion Act. It was essentially a travel ban. We have been this for a very long time, and we have a lot to work through.
Do you want to say what you what is Donald Trump drawing on, Atoussa? I mean, he certainly manages it, manipulates it brilliantly, but how deep?
I think he's tapping into the fears of, you know, aging white people who are scared of becoming a minority, who are scared of not having as much power. And from that perspective, you know, anyone who is threatened with losing power is going to react quite poorly. So I think that that's what's going on.
We're going to talk about that when we come back. Pat Buchanan has stuck his neck way, way out with a kind of paranoid, aging, white guy fear of a kind of collective suicide of a superpower, as he has written. I wonder, and we'll talk about it. Also, who is to decode the system and the thinking deep down that our border guards are defending at the highest levels of real financial power? Rana Dasgupta is the guy. His book forthcoming is After Nations. When we come back, this is Open Source. Rana Dasgupta is another widely traveled writer admired for his novels like Solo and his nonfiction Anatomy of India's Modern Capital, New Delhi. There is a big secret, he's writing now, and the migration crisis is a symptom of it and a distraction from it. It's said we live in a time of over-robust neo-nationalism around strongmen of the Trump or Putin or, in India, Modi variety. Rana Dasgupta's line is exactly the opposite. He says the nation state's real power, its tax base, and its responsiveness have been undone over recent decades by the supremacy of international money, which makes its own rules and turns its back on the results, including the migration crisis at our Texas border with Mexico.
Well, these are the moments when the obscenity of the current system are revealed in very, very intimate and dramatic ways. Then it comes down to actual human bodies in cages, and we realize that these are not abstractions at all. Those people are the scapegoats whom we are torturing in order to try and solve a problem that is much more profound than that.
Rana, in the simplest terms, what's the deeper trend under this convulsion around immigration?
The full story of the revolution that has happened since the 1980s, beginning in Britain and America, has not really been written. But it is a stupendous thing that has happened in our own lifetime. What has happened is that a group of rather brilliant elites have engineered a financial revolution which has reasserted the supremacy of capital over nation states and established a massive global system of offshore deposits as well as completely fluid movement that has transformed political systems in all the countries of the world. All political systems have been re-engineered to ensure that mobility of capital is uppermost and that taxation and all those kinds of things will fall into line with international norms.
Which is to say, tax collection and revenues will be diminished.
Exactly, which is to say essentially that all countries are competing with zero when it comes to tax levels. And if they have some other thing to offer of extreme value, which most rich countries do, then they will be able to compete very well with that zero tax rate. But many countries which have rather little to offer in terms of the exceptional nature of their workforce or whatever, will be driven down in quite brutal ways, which is why indebtedness is such a huge issue of poor countries. The ideology of a lot of the people who have spearheaded this revolution is explicitly anti-state. I mean, they are deliberately trying to undermine state systems, not only taxation systems, but they want other kinds of legal privilege too. Many of them are, to the greatest extent possible, living outside nation-state systems. In my own research, I've encountered billionaires who refuse to even visit France or Germany because they view them as totalitarian states, which, through their taxation systems, deprive individuals of the liberty that is properly theirs. And you know of all the experiments that are going on with seasteading and space exploration, all these fantasies of some kind of pioneer-like freedom. A lot of this is absurd stuff, but I think that the undermining of political authority has actually proceeded to a very great extent. What's happening right now is that the nudity of the emperor is beginning to show, both to the emperor himself and to everybody else, the kind of terror of what might be revealed on the other side of that kind of transition is gripping lots of people. So it's not just that leaders are trying to grab back the authority that they had in the 1960s by big shows of strength. It's also that populations are desperate for that authority to exist again. And that's why they too are voting for a kind of strange, nostalgic fantasy of past and present all rolled up into one.
Rana, you wrote in The Guardian that despite the strongmen and all the noise and rhetoric, political authority is running on empty almost everywhere. And that the noise is a symptom of that deep down realization.
The situation is very different in different places. There are countries such as Turkey, India, and China right now where authoritarian leadership is accompanied by fairly rapid economic growth. It's not as rapid as it used to be, but it's still fairly rapid. And so there are so many people gaining from the situation that there is quite a strong level of consent to authoritarian leadership. In the West, there is not that level of economic growth. And 40 years of increasing inequality in nearly all the rich world is now beginning to produce serious social problems. Those levels of inequality in Britain and America, we're reaching, as we know from Thomas Piketty, early 20th century levels of inequality and a kind of financial aristocracy that is increasingly not contained by any nation state. They have offshore money, they have property in many places, they send their kids to school and university in countries other than their own, and they are conspicuously avoiding paying taxes into the national exchequer to support their less fortunate compatriots. So they're kind of opting out of the nation state system, and everyone else is beginning to feel that they are being betrayed by national politics, and there's an extremely aggressive attempt to take it back, which takes all kinds of very aggressive forms. In France, we've seen just how powerful the far right has been, which has a strongly anti-Muslim platform, an overtly racist one. In Hungary, we've seen the government try to criminalize any action taken to assist illegal immigrants. There aren't actually that many in Hungary. They're all going through Hungary to get to Germany. And in Britain, you've had Brexit. You've had Britain pulling out of an extremely successful political experiment that's been going on in one way or another since just after the Second World War. These are tumultuous kinds of proceedings. The rise of the far right, the upturning of old elites, political elites, in favor of populism. And these are the kind of crisis situations that are being produced. Global capital also thrives off the distribution of poverty and war and lawlessness. The fact that there's no legal protection for a lot of the resources in Africa today, in countries like the Congo, is extremely useful to people who want to access those resources without going through red tape. So increasingly, we get to a situation where a large part of the world can offer very little to its own citizens, and they are forced to leave. They leave because they have very few economic opportunities. They leave because, in fact, they're in an economy which is trying to expel them. The African economy simply doesn't need most Africans. It's an extractive economy. They leave because of enormous ecological degradation. And they leave, of course, because of war and security issues. So there are more and more reasons why people will move. The nation-state system has produced this logic of movement, and now it must solve it. But unfortunately, there's nothing in the nation-state system that can address the movement of 65 million people, which is the number of refugees we have in the world today.
That was Rana Dasgupta. His book in progress is called After Nations. He teaches half the year at Brown University. Atoussa Abrahamian is the author of Cosmopolites. We read you everywhere now on immigration issues. Matt Cameron's a lawyer who practices immigration law from East Boston, our window on that whole world. Atoussa, you write, the global citizen that you write about is a billionaire with all sorts of passports. He could live anywhere or nowhere, as in those tax-free seasteads or space stations. An obnoxious model, I suppose, but would you want to make a case for global citizenship for the rest of us? I'm going to put the same question to Matt, too. You want to? Should we all be global citizens? That's for you, Atoussa. Matt, your turn. Quick.
That's the first question that I ask my class that I teach at Northeastern University, graduate immigration policy. I start the class by asking, why do we have an immigration system? And invariably, the answer is so that we know who is a citizen and who isn't. And to have to confront what it would mean if we didn't know that, if we didn't have that realization or that assumption, if nationalism was not the place that we started from, it's something to consider, because I think it's where we're headed and I think it's where we need to be in many ways. As the last guest was saying, we're headed for a place where I'm not sure we're going to have a choice.
The man without a country is in an unenviable spot. How do you make it a positive?
As we're talking about before, I do think ultimately I have enough faith in humanity that people, when you give them the chance to thrive, they will thrive. And they do every time. Refugees invariably contribute to this country in ways that I wish people were talking about more, because we continue to talk about them like there's some sort of burden, like they're here to take something from us, but they always give us more than they'll ever take.
Atoussa, we don't want to be your caricature global citizen who has loyalty nowhere and money offshore, but do you want to make a case for global citizenship for all of us?
I can, and I do. I think that global citizenship can be closer to what the ancient Greeks thought of it, and that is a sort of a series of concentric circles of belonging. So you may first feel like you're part of your neighborhood or your district, your community. Then you can feel like you're part of your city, your state, your country, the world. And none of these are mutually exclusive. I think that the problem with nativism and tribalism is that it does seem like they are, but they're really not. They're really not.
Who's going to locate, as we were saying, the fundamental angst in this whole subject? Charles Blow, op-ed in the New York Times, said this week it's all about white extinction anxiety, the coming end of white majority power in the United States. And Pat Buchanan seems to have volunteered for the role to embody it. But has he and others looked at the migration numbers and projected them forward? How could we possibly immunize this continental country against global trends and global movement? What do you think, Atoussa?
I don't know that we necessarily need to immunize the U.S. from global trends. I think that the U.S. is part of the world and needs to accept its role as part of the world. I think that some trends are worse than others, and I think that you can, for example, if you're talking about, you know, lower wages worldwide or growing inequality, you can pass policies to alleviate these problems. And I think that the politician that you kept referring to, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is proposing, you know, these kinds of solutions. I hope that more people will.
Matt Cameron.
Well,
the angst.
Sure. The angst is unfortunately driven by open displays of white supremacy and white nationalism. And it's very sad in 2018 that we're talking about this, that we're talking about people who are allowed to be out in the public and exercising this kind of rhetoric without consequence. That Steve King could tweet last year that we can't have a civilization with somebody else's babies. That Paul Ryan is encouraging American women to have more babies, and of course by American women he invariably means white women, at the same time that he's rejecting a solution for DACA, for the DREAM Act, which would give us a million young people right now of working age that we need to support our social safety net, and they want to deport them and replace them with these white babies. The fact that we're having these conversations now in the age of Trump, I hope that this really is the end of this kind of rhetoric with Trump.
We would need, in any event, a new national narrative as to who we are and how we got here. And I'm trying to imagine, if it were well tested, how we would choose a fantasy of Fortress America. Can you?
Certainly that's what Trump is selling. But, I mean, if you really look at our history, what we are is a Spanish colony at some point. Most of the southern border was Mexico for quite a while. There's no reason that we are invariably... The continent is a white European continent. That's not necessarily at all the story that we need to have.
Atusa, I want your newcomer take on the narrative that would be required. Is the narrative, the immigrant narrative, in the danger Donald Trump thinks it is? I don't. Of course, we live in Boston. It's an immigrant town. My grandparents came here. Everybody I know is basically is on that boat. But can you imagine the narrative that would supersede that?
I think there's a narrative that a lot of Americans think is the American narrative, which is the nation of immigrants one, that is now, you know, a sentence that was taken off the Immigration Services website. I think that to reconstruct that, I don't think that you can be nostalgic and look to the past, because as we've pointed out many times in this conversation, the good old days were, you know, some of them were pretty bad old days. There was this Chinese Exclusion Act. I think that it's going to take a lot to rebuild. And I frankly, I don't know how. But I do think that taking class, financial and economic inequality into consideration will go a long way.
Pat Buchanan would be chiding us for ethnomasochism. It's his word for the taking of pleasure in the dispossession of one's own ethnic group, a disease of the heart, he says, that never afflicted the America of Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, or Dwight Eisenhower. It comes out of what James Burnham called an ideology of Western suicide, Buchanan writes. A belief system that provides a morphine drip for people who've come to accept the inevitability of their departure from history. Why do those guys write so such inflammatory language? I mean, they've mastered the rhetoric somehow.
That's 3 in 5 babies born in this country right now are not white, and that is the terror. That's what's coming from this, and. It's horrifying what you just read. The idea that we'd go back to the days of Andrew Jackson, which of course Trump has identified as one of his favorite presidents, someone who committed genocide openly, that he'd reference him as someone that was part of the good old days that we're just talking about. But it's very sad to hear it framed that way when this is a reality, and to talk about that somehow we're taking pleasure in it or that we're, you know, masochist for embracing this reality and seeing what this country can be, it's very hard to see.
For joining the world, Atusa, you get the last response.
I agree that this what you just read is horrifying, and it's also pretty ahistorical. I mean, if you can't say that the people who ran this country, you know, years and years and years ago, were in any way committed to racial purity because they were busy raping slaves. You know, that's completely crazy. And they only use these things to serve their own agendas, cynical agendas.
It'd be tough even to make an eternal model out of the last 50 years of Pax Americana, which, of course, President Kennedy denied we wanted, and yet he led us into it. And in some degree, we've never come out of it, out of the Vietnam syndrome. George H.W. Bush, the civilized patriarch, it was said, rejoiced that in the Iraq War, the first one and the second one, his sons, we had licked the Vietnam syndrome. I mean, that prospect going forward, American arms ruling a subject world, a resentful world, doesn't sound like a plan either. Matt, last word?
It's not the future that Trump is. We are pulling back, as you said, to Fortress America, and that's the future that we may have if we do not watch now what is happening. And I encourage everyone listening to do that.
Thank you, Matt Cameron. Thank you, Rana Dasgupta and Atusa Araxia Abrahamian. Thanks also to Patricia Montes at Centro Presente in East Boston. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our border guard. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.